When kids are at the center of divorce, do they get a choice or just stability? Lauren Crane and Morgan Mazura break down custody trends, high conflict cases, and what parents need to know.
Welcome to Women Winning Divorce, the podcast helping successful women navigate divorce with dignity so you can protect yourself, your children, and your assets. I'm Heather Quick, founding attorney at Florida Women's Law Group, where women win at life.
This week, we had Lauren Crane and Morgan Mazura on the show. We had a great conversation about high net worth divorces, complex custody matters, and protecting children's stability. They shared insights on navigating extreme parental alienation, the evolving role of children in custody decisions, and practical strategies for parents to manage conflict while safeguarding their family. Welcome to this week's episode of Women Winning Divorce. I'm Heather Quick, owner and attorney at Florida Women's Law Group. Today, I'm joined by New York City family law attorneys Lauren Crane and Morgan Mazura, partners at Bender & Crane LLP. They both represent high net worth clients in complex financial and custody matters, including high conflict cases and parental alienation. Lauren is also a skilled mediator appointed to the New York County Supreme Court's roster of matrimonial mediators. And Morgan is particularly experienced in advocating for children's voices in custody disputes. Today, we will be discussing the challenges of high net worth divorces in complex custody cases. What stability and choice really means for kids caught in divorce, and practical ways that parents can navigate alienation, conflict, and co-parenting disputes. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you so much for having us.
Absolutely. This is very exciting. I love having lawyers on the podcast, especially lawyers who do family law, because then, you know, we all speak the same language, and I find it also very informative and fascinating to me just how different our states are in general. So we're going to dive into all of that stuff that I just talked about in the intro, but I would love for you to both say hello, and then we'll kind of get into each of you, how you got into family law.
Hi, so I'm Lauren, and I got into family law because my father was a divorce attorney in New Jersey, and so I followed his path. And he also represented high net worth individuals in New Jersey. So when I was looking for a job, he explained to me what goes into being a divorce lawyer and what high net worth individuals, what you will face and discuss and litigate. And I was really interested in the complexity of high net worth divorces. You have business interests, so valuing the business interest to me was very interesting. Also learning about different types of assets and coming up with the amount of support and how people live. To me, that was really interesting when I first got into divorce law.
Awesome. All right. And Morgan, your path is a little different, right?
So unlike Lauren, I am the first lawyer in my family. So, and all I can remember from a really young age is that I knew I wanted to be either in politics or a lawyer, which is very silly because no one in my life had touched that. And while I was in law school, went to law school in Manhattan, and the laws were really changing drastically in New York and in the country about family law. Gay marriage was being passed, and I knew that I wanted to be in an area of law that was changing, and I knew I wanted to litigate. And so I just started taking classes more in that area, and I just loved the uniqueness of every case. No case is the same. Even when we have clients come in and they're like, well, my person said this happened, and they may even have the same judge, and it still isn't the same. So I was very, you know, fascinated by that unique system.
Now, and what drew you to advocate for children specifically in custody disputes?
So New York is uniquely situated. I know there are some other states that do it as well, but not every state does it, that the children are appointed their own lawyer or guardian. And so to see that in real time, that the children have a voice, when often when you're representing a parent, sometimes the children, become the overlooked. They're just being told what's going to happen. And I was really compelled to make sure that the kids have a say and have someone they can talk to. In New York, you also have to usually be on the A&B panel to be appointed as a child attorney for the children, which means that you also have to help people who can't afford lawyers in different family law matters. And so, unfortunately, there are not as many people getting on the panel because you can't, it's hard to do both. And so, you know, it really, I really wanted to be involved in this and make sure there are people doing this.
Well, that's great. Now, both of you deal with extremely high conflict situation. What keeps you passionate about this work, even when it can get emotionally taxing?
So I think when you have high conflict, the thing that we can help do for our clients is bring down the conflict and try to support the client. Such as when clients come in, we generally tell them that it would be helpful if they got mental health treatment at the same time, as this is going to be a very emotional experience, even if they don't understand that when they first come in. Because when they come in, they still think that their spouse is their partner, even though they're getting a divorce. And they don't realize all of a sudden you're going to be on the opposite sides of tables, in front of a judge, arguing over things that you originally had agreed upon, such as how much we're going to spend a month, where we're going to send our kids to school. And all of a sudden, basic issues that you had always agreed upon become the hot button issues that really wouldn't have been if the party stayed married. Mm-hmm. So it's our job to bring some sort of leveling down, to discuss with them what they really want to get out of this divorce, and try and talk them out of pursuing certain litigation for revenge rather than for the best interests of either their children or for them. So I think that's the best part that we can do for our clients.
You asked us at a very interesting time. A lot of our cases right now seem to be emotionally taxing. There's a lot of conflict happening just right now for whatever reason. So Laura and I often have the conversation of how are we still able to do this? Because, you know, they take a lot on us, right? And, you know, the beauty of COVID is that, like, now everyone can contact you anytime, all the time. There's so, you know, for that's partly the good and the bad, but there's like less office hours, right? We have clients contacting us all the time and can reach us virtually all the time. And so I think Laura and I sometimes debrief each other and we remind ourselves, you know, these people are going through literally the most emotional taxing thing ever, right? Because partly they're going to be spending time away from their children in a world that they never thought possible, right? You have kids, you think I'm never going to be away from them significant periods of time, but this is the new reality. And so we'd be like, okay, we have to give them grace. We give ourselves grace and we keep it going.
I agree. You know, I think that is in family law in particular, because there are issues that, and, you know, I'll just speak, you know, the three of us, you know, as women, you can relate to, right? And there are some situations, you know, it's really bad. So boundaries are so important. And having, you know, to not respond and be off so that then you can recharge to be back on, to do this incredibly taxing work that we do, which is, you know, adversarial in nature when you're in court and you're just advocating so hard. And sometimes, you know, our client is doing the right thing. They're listening to us. We're doing their husband's a pain in the butt and they're making it more difficult for them. As you know, we represent women only, so I always refer to it that way. It can be the reverse, you know, and or the judge just doesn't see it that way. And, you know, I was explaining it to someone the other day. It's like, we can prepare as lawyers just expertly, you know, we are ready and we do the best job ever. And our client does the best job and the judge just might not see it the way we see it. And that is, you know, for attorneys, difficult, right? Because we're always wanting to get those results and also for clients. So I think for those of us who practice in it and stay in it and still, you know, can do it without being too cantankerous all the time, it's because you have to have some boundaries. You have to have an opportunity to, and we have more wins than not, right? We see more opportunities where the clients are really in such a better place and we're able to get them in a better situation, settlement, whatever it may be. So that's like, okay, the ones where we're in court and it's just a battle. and it doesn't always go your way. Those are not the majority of what we do, hopefully, right?
Totally. And, you know, when the judge doesn't see it your way, explaining it to your clients who, you know, just feels when they walk into that courtroom, I have everything on my side, and you do it, and it just, you know, it's, I mean, in New York, you know, the law's not black and white. The courts have so much discretion. And so they, you know, those are the tough days. Those are the tough days.
The other tricky part, I think, about representing high net worth individuals in a court system with a judge, it's the first time they're hearing, no, you can't do what you want. You can't have everything you want. And you're not going to. You're going to be doing what I tell you to do. So you have these CEOs or high earning individuals sitting next to you, and they're looking at you saying, I run a business. Yeah. And this guy sitting on a bench is going to tell me what to do. You know, it's the first time someone's giving them a no. Yeah. And that's also really hard for us when we have to explain it to them.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Now, you two have been seeing a trend in your local jurisdiction that courts are not so quick to appoint attorneys for younger children. Why do you think that's happening?
So I do think that the courts are trying, or encouraging, I should say more, that the parties should try to resolve it first. So usually throwing in another person doesn't always help. Sometimes it can, but sometimes it can hurt, because then it becomes a two against one type of situation if the attorney for the child leans one way or the other.
Okay.
But I do think the courts really are giving the parties a lot of leeway, saying, listen, you should decide what you want for your child, not me. I'm going to hear certain things, but I'm not going to know what you know. Yeah. And so I think there is that little step back to say, why don't you guys try before we throw someone else in the mix? I do also see that the courts are trying to, they're not trying to, they're also leaning a little bit away from forensics. In our jurisdiction, there's custody forensics, where they have the parties evaluated for their parenting capacities or mental health issues. Mm-hmm. I do see that the courts are not so jumping to that. It's a very expensive and lengthy process. Mm-hmm. And then you end up getting, if someone doesn't like the results, that person hires an expert. Then you have competing experts, and it just is throwing more chaos into already chaotic system. Although, I mean, you know, there are situations where you can't avoid it, where there really are concerns about someone's parenting or drug use or anything, but that's what we're seeing.
Interesting. Well, now on the issue of the children, in New York, is there, whether it's by statute or just kind of, you know, common or local rules, what age do children's preferences really start to carry weight in the eyes of the court?
That's a great question. That's a great question. There is no like set rule. Yeah. It is up to the judge's discretion. It's also up to the judge's discretion. There are two ways that someone could be appointed for a child. One is a guardian ad litem, and they're not an attorney, their guardian, representing their best interest, like their best interests, and don't have to necessarily represent what that child is saying. And then there's an attorney for the child, which has like rules as an attorney that has to zealously represent what their client is saying. And the judges even differ on the age to say, should it be a guardian or should it be an attorney for the child? You know, there could be, you could be appointed, I could be appointed to represent a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old. Yeah. And, you know, it's difficult because the rules say certain things of what I'm supposed to do, and I'm supposed to say what they say. But, you know, how you have those conversations with a young child and explain to them what's going on is complicated, because you don't want to over-parentify a child. You don't want to also give them like false hope that they're the decider. You don't want them to really know, you know, the bad things going on between their parents, because you don't want them to feel like they have to choose a side. So there's no real age. And I think every judge sort of does what they think is right. Now, the judge can also speak if they go all the way to a trial. They can conduct a Lincoln hearing and hear from the child themselves. And again, that's the judge's discretion.
Got it. Got it. Yeah, I often clients say, like, well, I heard, you know, or I read that when they're 13, like Google says when they're 13, they get to decide. And I was like, I don't know where it says that on the internet, but it's not true.
And then when can we leave our kid home alone? What's the age that they're allowed? Because they're always worried about that. What's the appropriate age?
Okay. It's like when you're in the middle of the divorce, don't do it.
Don't do it.
Don't do it. Don't do it. No, no, no. Wait till we're out of the out of the spotlight. Then you can do whatever you think is best.
Right. If you're relying on AI to determine what you need to do, follow your gut and just don't do it.
Yeah, don't do it. If you have to ask, then you probably shouldn't do it, right?
Exactly.
But it's so hard, as we know, because our clients, you know, they're in this situation and right, your normal activities every day, now everything can be scrutinized and looked at in a different way. So they get a bit paranoid, I think.
Yeah.
They do. And sometimes it's better. But I feel for them because then they're wanting, like, well, what should I do?
The power.
10 minutes late to pick them up. What should I do? It's almost as if there's a temporary block of that what's reasonable and what you should do. It doesn't come to them naturally anymore.
You know, it's an interesting thing that's come up more recently than it used to come up is parents are co-sleeping with their kids for a lot longer than they used to.
Okay.
So then once this divorce happens, the parent who didn't want to co-sleep all of a sudden says it's unnatural that they co-sleep and tries to use it against them. Mm. Or the parent who co-sleeps, who wanted to co-sleep, now says, I don't want them in the bed with the other parent. We have to move immediately to separating the beds. And I find that that winds up being a hot button issue.
I bet.
Right now, it's more than ever. I've seen it probably in half of our cases, which is very interesting because I never saw it before.
Yeah, that is, I guess, whatever's going on with the trends. Yeah. Now, Morgan, since you often represent children, how do you balance what a child says they want with what you deem or what you know to be what you think is in their best interest?
So if I'm an attorney, if I'm appointed as an attorney for them, I'm under a strict guideline of how and when I can substitute my judgment. And the complicated part about it is every court, we have four different appellate courts because the New York is big, New York State. So each department determines it a little bit differently, but the rule is the same. And there's only two situations when I can substitute my judgment. And one is if I think that there's for the child. And usually I would say that's in a case of drug use or something along those lines or, you know, safety risks. And then the other one is if I don't think that what the child is saying is knowing voluntary, like a voluntary admission. And so the problem with that one is some courts think that alienation, right? So when you know a child, I can tell very clearly when a child is just parroting to me what a parent has told them. Because all it takes is, I don't even ask any direct questions. It's a couple follow-up questions. And there's just no logical line from what they're saying to what, you know, to how they got there. Some courts will allow me to say, okay, that's enough. If the alienation is severe, that I can substitute my judgment. Some won't. Some still require me to advocate for the client's position. So when I'm in that position, I say what the child wants, but then I'm also allowed to talk to their school, their therapist, if they have one, the doctor. I try to bring in the other third parties to sort of mitigate or let the court understand that because they're saying this, there's no connection to it. So hopefully the court, when they hear it, they don't give it as much weight because it's not actually what the child wants.
Okay, right. Well, and that is good bringing up alienation because that was another question or the next question because Lauren, right now you're handling cases involving extreme alienation claims right now. You know, and what does that look like for you? How are the courts evaluating those? Because those are extremely hard cases for us here in Florida.
I find them the hardest because it is so hard to address and the court system is slow. So sometimes when a parent is initially raising it, you know, you'll sometimes get supervised visitation just so the court can, not for the purposes of protecting the child, but so that the court has someone to say exactly what's happening during the visitation. Uh-huh. And so the other parent will then say, well, they got supervised visitation because they're a danger, but that's not really why they're getting supervision. It's just to, and it's also usually so gradual. You know, it happens bit by bit. And slowly kids turn. And the problem is there's only really one method that's I've ever seen work is where they go away, the whole family, to a retreat, right? I'm going to call it a retreat, where every person is involved, the person accused of alienation, the parent being alienated, and the kids. And they do either a weekend or longer. and they do these interventions where they teach everyone mm-hmm. how to treat each other, where they have the kids say exactly what they feel about the other parent, where basically everything is out in the open. And then when they leave this retreat, they then come back to New York. I mean, that's where we work. So they would come back and they have a system. They have an overall therapist who would oversee it. And then the kids would have therapists. The parents will have therapists mm-hmm. together. And then they really work on a plan to make it better. The problem is it gets to a point where it's so far gone that sometimes it doesn't work, right? Because the courts are slow. Courts aren't fast to order these, you know, retreats. And also it may take a hearing to order a retreat mm-hmm. like this. So by the time you're done with pre-litigation, a trial, you know, the children may be extremely alienated. Mm-hmm. And the truth is alienation, once the kids are adults, it can really mess them up with their romantic partners, with friendships, because they cannot rely on another person, right? Their North Star, the parent that they're aligning with, may not be showing them how to treat other people by the way that they're mm-hmm. acting. So the kids take it upon themselves to act as that parent. And that can ruin all their relationships in the future. Just alienation in those types of cases keeps me up at night, because I just can't imagine those kids as adults. It's the follow through yeah. in the future. To not have one parent be in your life is a horrible thing, I think, for kids.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and they are difficult, and they, you know, so fact intensive, and you just need so many of the right people engaged with it. And, you know, in some of the experiences we've had, the parent doing the alienating, they have no desire to get better, to do anything different. And so it's just a constant battle, and really sad. Definitely.
So sad. And sometimes they only react when child support's taken away or money's taken away, mm-hmm. which is even sadder, because it's yeah. really a detriment to that child.
Do higher financial stakes create different or additional challenges when it comes to custody and co-parenting decisions?
I think the money changes the dynamics for custody.
Okay.
I find that people who determine to use custody as a manipulative tool in the thing will do whether they have money or don't have money. That is a personality trait, I find, right? Then more than just necessary of having money or not having money. I mean, I think, sort of not related to your question, but really truthfully, that no matter, people always ask us, what do you find the common trends are? And to me, the most fascinating thing is, while we primarily deal with high net worth, I also, because I'm on the 18B panel, deal with clients that don't have money. Everyone complains about the same things at the core. Everyone is the same. I mean, really, relationships, dynamics between men and men, women and women. I mean, we all have the same base complaints when it comes to childhood, yeah. child rearing. It's really very fascinating to me. You know, whether you have a million people helping you or no one helping you, you're still complaining that your spouse is not helping, is not contributing, or not, you know, like it's, or they have no idea who the teacher is. It's all the same, amazingly.
Yeah. Now let's talk about, you know, navigating the emotional aspects of divorce, like a little bit about what you mentioned earlier, Lauren, you know, when you're dealing with individuals who, you know, have held powerful positions in the finance business world, you know, what they're doing, where they're used to being in control of all parts of their life, as well as probably the rest of their family. And now you've got to help them navigate that they are no longer calling the shots. How do you do that?
So I also find, when on the opposite side, which you will understand, you know, typically when people are married, they have a division of labor. So I'm going to say the working husband with the stay-at-home mom. We'll just use that as
a
baseline.
Example. Yeah.
Where the stay-at-home mom would make decisions, you know, this child's going to go to gymnastics this night. This child's going to go to tennis this night. And they've made those decisions. Let's say the kids are in early 10s, you know, 8 and 10, mm-hmm. so forth. And then all of a sudden they're getting divorced and they say, well, I want to enroll her in dance. And all of a sudden they have to navigate and ask the other parent, do you agree with dance? And yes. Before it would be just, I enrolled her in dance.
Right.
So it doesn't really matter if they're the CEO of the company or the CEO of the home, we'll say.
Yeah.
It is a hard navigation to learn how to communicate, first of all, which they probably haven't done in a while in a very meaningful way, and then to make decisions together. You know, my child needs to switch schools. They have an educational need. Well, this one's going to find this place. And if the other person's so angry, they'll revengefully say, no, never that school. And then you go down this path. And then all of a sudden, you're asking a parent, do you have parent coordinators?
We do.
Okay, so then you're meeting with a parent coordinator who doesn't know your family, right? Until they start really getting involved. And that person gets involved. Or you're going to a court and a judge. And a judge is forced to make these decisions. I think with anyone, having to make a decision with someone who you're sitting at the opposite ends of a table in a courtroom is very hard. And that navigation, that learning how to speak to that person in a different way, because obviously the communication styles didn't work when they were married, that is the most important thing that we can teach our clients, because even once your kid is emancipated, you still have kids together. They could be adults. They're still your kids. And you still have to have a relationship. They're going to get married, hopefully. And you'll have to be at the wedding together. You'll have to go to college graduations or high school graduations. To teach them how to treat their former spouse is the best thing that we can do as divorce attorneys so that they can have a pleasant experience for themselves and for their kids.
All right, Lauren, I'm tasking you with writing that book because you're right. It's easier said than done, as we all know, because we have a lot of repeat clients who are dealing with the same issues over and over. But I agree with you completely. Like, if we're able to help them navigate that, it will make their lives and really probably their children's lives so much better, for sure. Now, let's talk about mediation, because in Florida, mediation is mandatory in all family law cases before you go to trial. But I do not think that is the case in New York, is it?
No, you don't need to go to mediation. You have to actually, you can always mediate. Any person outside of the court system can mediate. Within the court system, either the judge will recommend it or the parties will ask for it. And I'm on the panel, so they'll get, you know, I think it's 90 minutes. I give more than that where it's free, and then they pay a mediation expense. Mm-hmm. But usually they're referenced out to mediation after 2 or 3 years being in the court system.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's almost when they sit in my office, I think to myself, couldn't you have come in 6 months after you started this? So it's usually too late. It's really too late. I think that mediation either has to happen after complete litigation fatigue or right in the beginning before everyone gets entrenched. I think those are the two prime times.
And as since it's not mandatory, I would guess it depends a lot on, you know, opposing counsel, but oftentimes, maybe, are you guys able to work with the other attorney and say, you know, we should try to mediate this for the clients? Does that work often?
Yeah, I mean, our position always is what can we settle, even if it's issue by issue. So whether we are suggesting a mediator or working it out between counsel, we are always encouraging our clients to try to resolve what they can. The litigation, you know, line is expensive. It's the unknown, right? You have judges, like we talked about, you can say everything. They just view it differently.
Mm-hmm.
We tell them, you want some control in this decision? Mediate it. Help you take control. You two decide what you want, what you think works best for your family. Sometimes we're able to, sometimes we're not, you know, and it can be opposing counsel specific if they are sometimes entrenched. I mean, there are, you know, attorneys out there, I'm sure there are by you, that you know that if they're on the other side, there are certain things.
They're not settling. Yeah.
Which is frustrating for everyone. I'm sure the court system too. But yeah, we are always in a position trying, even if we break things apart, what can we settle?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After every court appearance, we approach our clients to say, this is how horrible it is. You have one coming up, let's say in 2 months or 6 weeks, whatever it is, or 3 months. Let's try and settle. We could settle this maybe. Even if we settle one issue after every court appearance, because court appearance are gut-wrenching to the client.
Yeah.
You know, that no client, even if they win, let's say they win everything, still being interrogated or having your life on display before a full courtroom is horrifying to these people. Mm-hmm. I don't care who you are. So after every court appearance, we do approach our clients and say, is there anything you think we can settle? Get this off the table. You know you don't want the judge to decide this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. Very often, I do think, even though it's mandatory in Florida, sometimes it's helpful that we've had a hearing so they can kind of see what they're looking at, like just kind of see what the judge decided. Sometimes just as powerful if it was against our client, because like, okay, that is what we're looking at. You thought this was so straightforward, you know, or even if for our client, you know, for, you know, we deal with the women and their husbands, you know, aren't, I'm not paying you that. And sometimes like, well, we probably need hearing so that the judge can tell him that he is going to pay that. And now we're more ripe for mediation because now he's had a taste of being told what to do. And hopefully that will have an impact. But I do think that there, you know, it can be very helpful to have been in a courtroom setting and just know, right? Like you said, because every, you know, there's, we have several judges, obviously, in multiple counties. You know, how is that judge? What does he think about what you've said, right? In regards to the children, he may be like, that's nothing. That child is fine. You know, I'm not, I don't take that seriously, which, you know, can happen often, as we know, our clients, and you know, I'm not going to say particularly the moms, but, you know, an issue about, it could be anything, their education, their food, their diet, their medication. And you know, those things can be so polar opposites. But the husband, like, saying, no, this is not, I don't want my child medicated, I want this. Those are tough issues for the people going through it and tough decisions the judges have to make in those kind of cases.
Absolutely. You know what makes it worse also, and we tell all of our clients, please don't talk to your friends. Don't go to your girlfriend. Don't go to your you know, your mom's best friend, because it is just amps up everything. And then they know a friend who knows a friend who this, you know, and, you know, you're off to the races. And it's just hard, you know?
Mm-hmm. We were talking about AI before. You know, we get emails. This is what AI says I can get. And this is what we should do. So sometimes they'll say to them, you should retain AI. It'll do a great job.
And you know, I know we're laughing, but it's true. It's like, listen, if that, why are you paying me if you are not listening to me, but then looking for the answer you want, and you're going to generally find it and then, you know, bring that to me. I think that's the challenge of our area of practice, right? Because our clients, one, everybody knows somebody who's been through it and they want what they got, or they don't want what they got, you know, either way. And it's like, but you, it's so, like we talked at the beginning of the show, Morgan, you're saying, you know, it's so fact specific. And that is one of our big education things with, you know, we try with our clients, like, listen, your case really is individual. The law is what it is, but so many things can be interpreted. There's a lot of, on some things, room for interpretation with the judge. And, you know, they may be getting something, but their finances may not be what yours are. So that spousal support isn't going to look the same. Even though you think it's the same, you know, it's tough. I feel like that is one of the hardest obstacles that we as family law attorneys face, is our clients' really unrealistic expectations based on TV, movies, and best friends and family and everything that's happened.
Totally.
Right?
And they always believe theirs is the worst. You've never seen anyone worse than this person. This judge, there's just no way. He's so, like, it's so bad. How could he not?
I know.
Or someone gets divorced. You were talking about other counties. This one got divorced by this judge in this county, and they got this. So I can get the same thing. You're not even in the same county. You don't have the same judge. And, you know, AI, I really want to tell people, AI doesn't go before a judge. Every judge has their own perception, their own, I'm not going to say biases, but some have been doing it longer, some have been doing it shorter. You know, they have their own personality. They're going to make a decision based on the law and what they see is the right thing to do. And I don't know how to tell the clients over and over, that's a different judge. That's a different court. They had a longer marriage, you know, on spousal support. There's so many factors. There's no formula, right? You're not putting it in a blender and it's all going to come out the same.
No, it really, and I know they get frustrated by that, but I feel like we as attorneys can't talk about it enough because they do. The timing, we talked a little bit about that, right? Like you're maybe try to mediate after 2 years, but I've said this so many times because, you know, if we can meet our clients where they are, which is, you know, and I'm a big Law and Order fan, but like, you know, they're like, hey, man, somebody committed a crime. They investigated, caught him, tried him, and done in 60 minutes. And that's with commercials, you know? So why aren't we done? And it's like, let me just tell you, 6 months is really, really fast. And everything must go according to plan. You guys must agree on everything. And then that can happen. I won't say it can, but it can take is a challenge for our clients. Even when we say it, I don't think they believe us or hear us, you know?
No, because they can't fathom it. I think that's right. They think we're talking to like encourage them to settle. So maybe we're not being as, but it's in New York. I mean, there are 5 judges who do matrimonial law for the island of Manhattan. So just think about that and how many people they had in the long list. And so, I mean, cases really never really recovered from COVID, how backed up it was. I mean, our cases are taking years. So it's really, they come in and like, how much is this going to cost me? And how long?
And when we can't say, well, it depends. And they're like, what do you mean? You can't tell me, right?
I was like, well, if I had a magic ball and I could tell you right now, I'm telling you right now, I would not be sitting in this chair, be doing something else with my time if I had those powers.
Also, when you tell your client, as reasonable as you are, is how fast it could go. Totally. If you're willing to bend and deal with your spouse in a way, it will move the matter. Mm-hmm. And then they come to an issue and they're like, absolutely not. I will never do what he wants me to do. I will never do what she wants me to do. And then you say, well, that extends your case. Yeah. And they look at you and say, I'm not bending on that anyways. And so then you say it's in your hands.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really is. I think, and when, you know, and I think what this is saying exactly what you guys are saying, right? It's the court system. It's the government. It moves slower than they really think is humanly possible, but it does. And it is going to impose upon you the laws of your state and all of that. And so if you really want, you know, the freedom to make things that, you know, there's going to have to be a give and take. Nobody agrees to like their worst day in court. And, you know, so you've got to be willing to work through it. And I think the hardest thing is when you're divorcing, your emotions are really high and you're really mad at that person, really sad about this. You're just not in an agreeable state of mind.
It also may be the first time someone's making a deal. Right? Let's take someone who used to be or is a teacher, right? And they're working as a teacher, and then all of a sudden they're expected to make a sophisticated business deal and they've never done it before. And so part of our job really is to explain it to them soup to nuts. When our clients leave us, we give them like a cheat sheet, we'll say, so they know what's going to happen, even if there's an agreement. It's very hard, right? We're used to it. It's our everyday thing. One of our biggest, I believe, Morgan and I, we really sit, we explain it to them in real world terms. You have to, because they don't get it. Or if it's the first time they're getting a lot of money, let's say, and they have to manage it, we tell them to get money managers. Rely on experts. Have them give you a budget. You know, these are things that people need to get used to. It's very hard the first time.
It is. And along the lines, like making, doing a complicated deal or something extensive, there's so many decisions to be made, which is overwhelming. And it's just, you know, helping them, you know, break them down and make the best decisions. Because I know there, you know, is often after a deal is made, oh, remorse, you know, oh, why did I do this? Why did I do that? And then you tell your family and they're like, my dad is so mad that I agreed to all this. It's like, oh my goodness. But he doesn't have to live your life, right? And he doesn't understand the court views, you know, your parents' father as an equal to you. He may not like him, but like, you know, he's their father. So there's just certain things that are going to happen. And I find that challenging for our clients because they're dealing with, like, say they've come to an agreement they were okay with, but then their family can get so upset. And then now all the emotions are back in and they just have a hard time. I don't know if you guys have experienced that as well.
Definitely. You know, I think there's the good and the bad. You know, when people are going through this, as we've discussed, like, they're emotionally at their height of what's happening. And so they really do need a family member sometimes to help them because it's really emotionally taxing. And on the same token, that family member sometimes also gets emotionally entrenched and then revs them up, right? Instead of just being the support, which you're hoping, and as an outsider, like, right, our job is to be like, I'm not emotionally attached to this, so I can help you make a decision. Because sometimes it's hard to see the forest through the trees when you are in it, right? And so that's our job as an advisor. And you hope when they have family or a friend there that they're going to help support you when they're on the other side cranking it up. And unfortunately, they often are. You know, now you're fighting two people trying to get this done.
Yeah, I think that's what... So it keeps it interesting in family law, because families are interesting. People are interesting, and it can backfire sometimes because that loyal family member is just like, what? Wait, why are you doing this? And yeah, it can make it more difficult on our clients often.
It's funny. I recently spoke to a former client of ours who, at the time when she signed the deal, she had this exact experience. And now it's 2 years later. And she actually called me and said, you know, I really appreciate what you did because your advice was so right. And exactly what you said was going to happen if I sign this deal is what's going to happen. And now, you know, they were fighting tooth and nail on custody. And guess what? The court's out of it. They're back to their old patterns. They're back to getting along better. Mm-hmm. If you end the litigation, even though it's not a perfect deal, sometimes that's the best deal you can do for you for to move on. Who wants to give up 4 years of their life to fight?
In tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Totally.
You know, because we talked about how long it will go, but we know the length of time in generally positively correlates to the amount of money you're going to spend.
Yes.
And it, you know, I have always said to our clients, like, I know you want to be done, right? And we're the ones being paid to help you, but I want closure for you because I can only imagine paying us for multiple years. I know it wears on you.
And I think that's what they also don't understand sometimes. Mm. We're trying to help a client say, this is a good deal for you.
Right.
As business women, yes, we keep the litigation going. It benefits us, right? We're in it. This is a business, right? Yes. And so, you know, we're telling you this because we genuinely believe it. We are not trying to make more money off of you. We're telling you, based upon what's happening, this is probably what is in your best interest.
You know, it's a big issue is when you talk to them and you say, I could get another X amount of money out of a deal with my spouse. And then I say to them, but cancel that against the counsel fees you're going to spend. So you have to net it out. Counsel fees has to be a factor when you're settling a case. Because the potential counsel fees, you know, could be anything. Mm-hmm. But if you settle it here for a little bit less money, you're going to be so much better off time and money wise.
Exactly. It's that cost benefit analysis. Oftentimes, I'm almost going over, but I think this is an important point that I would imagine that y'all would agree with is, you know, I've had very often, well, I heard my husband will pay all my fees. It's like, okay, well, that is probably unlikely unless he's voluntarily doing it. I'm not going to call him and ask him, but you know, in, you know, the evolution of the law over time, it, you know, used to be, and maybe many practices did that before I started practicing, you know, and would just like carry this balance and then the husband would write the check. But now, you know, they equalize everything at the end. And so it all was kind of marital money at the end of the day. And I also think that if our clients aren't paying as they go, they're not feeling the pain, you know, financial pain of their decisions.
That is so true. We have the same type of law in New York where there's a rebuttal presumption that the moneyed spouse pays for the non-moneyed spouse. They think that means it's dollar for dollar. Yep. And, you know, it goes both ways. Sometimes, if our, you know, it backfires for both of them. If a client gets a really big award and they have a ton of money, they're entrenched in the litigation thinking, like, I got this. It's not costing me anything. And then it's hard. It's really, really hard. But counsel fees are a huge piece of it. And it really does make a dent in their equitable distribution at the end of the day. So they have to be mindful of it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it is helpful, because I also think, you know, as clients, they want to do all these things, right? And we are problem solvers as lawyers. And we're like, oh, okay, yeah, let's take all these depositions, which in my early, early practice days, I'd be like, let's do it. And then I learned, like, no. We're going to see, does this help us achieve our objective? And then guess what? Let me tally up. This is probably how much all that's going to cost. So let's deposit that in the retainer, and then we'll take this course of action. That helps you make a better decision. If you're like, you know, do I want to do $10,000 worth of this and deposing the new girlfriend or the ex-girlfriend, you know, the secretary?
Is everything. Yeah. And we do that with parent coordination too. You know, if they don't want to split those fees, everybody has to be a willing participant financially. Yeah. If you don't have that, I just don't know if you're all on even playing field. And it really makes a difference to make sure everyone is showing up with the same good faith, you know, positions.
I agree. I can't believe we're out of time, but I'm not surprised, because I do. I get carried away in these great conversations. But our show is called Women Winning Divorce. So I always like to ask our guests, what does winning at life mean to you?
So as a working mom of two young children, winning at life for me is when I remind myself that I don't have to do the best every second on both ends, right? Sometimes not everything is perfect. I'm not always the best mom that I can be because I'm working. I'm not always the best at work because I want to be there to be for my kids, but that's okay. And giving myself that grace and teaching my children to give themselves that grace is what I view to be winning at life.
Oh, I love it. That's true. It is true.
So I'm at the other end of the spectrum with my kids. My daughter is about to turn 17 and she's a junior in high school. And she recently said to me, you know, she's preparing for the SATs and the ACTs. And she said to me, you know, Mom, I really want to do well on them so that I can go to college and I can be a really good mom who works and makes my own money and can rely on myself. Because you've taught me so well, because you're always there for me, and I know that I want to be that for my kids. And I have to tell you, I have a teenager, so it's a little shocking.
Yeah.
But it was really such a moment in my life, and it really did feel like winning. But as Morgan knows, winning to me is being retired in Costa Rica on a beach.
That's the real answer. That's the real answer.
Well, and that is a win. I know. And sometimes, though, it's like having your teenager appreciate you after, you know, all the blood, sweat, and tears that we've done, or, you know, having a good mom moment. So they're little ones, and then there's the big wins, right? The ultimate win at life, right? Which is on the beach in Costa Rica. You guys are amazing, and I really enjoyed this conversation. We'll have to think of another topic, which I know won't be difficult, and have you back.
Love that.
Yeah, it's been amazing to be here with you.
And lastly, where can our listeners find you for more information and resources?
So our website is bendercrane.com, Bender and Crane on LinkedIn, and that's where you can find us. All our contact information, our telephone, our email address is all on the website and on LinkedIn.
Wonderful. Well, and of course, they will be in the show notes for our listeners to find you. We've reached the end of our show today. Thank you so much, Lauren Crane and Morgan Mazur, for sharing your expertise on custody, children's advocacy, and high net worth divorce. Your insights on stability, alienation, and the role of mediation will help so many women listening today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, if you or someone you know in the Northeast Florida area is going through or even thinking about divorce, you're not alone. Taking that first step can feel overwhelming. But it doesn't have to be. Our newsletter is filled with actionable advice tailored to guide you through this process. By signing up, you'll gain the tools to face the unknown with courage and see if we're the right fit to support you during this life-changing time. Don't wait. Click the link in the show notes, fill out the form, and take the first step toward building a brighter future today.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not an advertisement for legal services. The information provided on this podcast is not intended to be legal advice. If you have a legal issue, please contact an attorney in your local jurisdiction. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests are solely those of the individuals and do not represent the views or opinions of the firms or organizations with which they are affiliated. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Any editing, reproduction, or redistribution of this podcast for commercial use or monetary gain without the expressed written consent of the podcast's creator is prohibited.